Blog Talk Radio.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
This is Dana Hayes here with another edition of Imperium Europa. The time is 8.04 p.m. It is Wednesday, October 30th, 2013. Right here on Renegade Broadcasting. Just a day before Halloween. Halloween, Samhain, the Celtic holy day, I guess you could say, that was co-opted by the Christian Church. But I have a very special guest tonight. I'm really looking forward to talking to. His name is Mark Dial, spelled Mark and then D-Y-A-L. And I first found out about him through countercurrents.com. You guys are well aware of that site. I have a lot of great New Right intellectuals on there, and he has a number of really great articles from epistemology and the New Right to Mussolini's New Fascist Man to We Are the Real Subaltern. So I really recommend people go and just do a Google search for him, and he will come up, and you'll have plenty to read. He's a very intriguing guy, an intellectual. I'm going to just read really quickly here right off the countercurrents. They describe him as an American scholar and writer. He has a master's in, wait for it, Black studies and a PhD in anthropology. His dissertation is on Italian ultras, so we'll be looking forward to hearing about them, soccer hooliganism, just everything related to this sphere of politics. And he has a focus in philosophy. He understands just the roots of these ideas, counter-enlightenment thinking from Nietzsche to Evola, Sorel, and in the indigenous European resistance to globalization, liberalism, and immigration. So he has a number of a wide range of experience, and I'm really looking forward to getting him on program, and he's here right now, so I'm going to just pull him up. Without any further ado, here is Mark Dial. I hope the connection is good. Mark, are you there?
I am here.
Great. You sound good. I'm going to check with the chat just to make sure everything is going well. I saw people posting quotes from your articles right in there, so everybody's pumped up and waiting to hear. There's a little bit of echo, but go ahead. Let's hear. I want to make sure before we go into it. But Mark, how are you tonight?
I'm very well. How are you, man?
All right, it's an honor to talk with you. What part of the country are you calling in from? Are you close by or east, west?
No, I'm down in Atlanta.
You're in Atlanta, okay. All right.
It's quite a hotbed down here for men like us.
Absolutely, the South. And is that where you were raised? Is this your background? They're telling me there is a bad echo. Were you able to, let me see, let me just check my speakers quick. I want to make sure everything is legit. All right, I don't know.
Yeah,
if
I'm not
Skype.
Yeah, I guess I'm getting an echo. Is that lag I'm hearing?
Yeah, you sound okay to me, but this happens.
Yeah, that sounded
single.
Good just then.
Yeah. All right. They're telling me to turn my speakers down, but if I do that, I don't know if I'm going to be able to hear you. Well, let me turn them down a little bit here.
Yeah, it's much better now for me. Although that just got popped.
All right, well, maybe that's what it is. It's just the speaker issue. Okay.
Well, if people complain, we can try to go to another audio source, I suppose.
Sure, okay. I guess they're saying it's I have this issue pretty much every time. Oh, they're telling me to get a headset. All right. Okay, we're good now. So,
okay, cool.
Okay, so you were born and raised in the South, are we correct?
Yeah,
why don't you just go into your whole just let it run, your story.
Yeah, I'll try to be as brief as I can. I was born and raised in Jacksonville, Florida. Probably my most formative experiences down there were at the beach. And so by the time I was in sixth grade, I was kind of became this surfer boy. And, and that's a great way to grow up. And, you meet great people, and it's kind of this earthy, grungy kind of environment. And from there, I became, well, the surfer boy was not a very good scholar or student. And so by the time I got to my college years, and miraculously, I got into Florida State. And so I went over to Tallahassee and did my bachelor's there. And, but I was already at that point spinning my wheels intellectually and maybe even professionally, because I didn't have – I don't have good bourgeois instincts, let's put it that way. You know, work in a cubicle kind of situation doesn't really come naturally for me, or I can't sell anything. You know, I don't really have a great interest in speaking to strangers. You know, so working for the man kind of thing never really worked out for me. So even from the time I was an undergrad, I really just had no clue. So I majored in communications, and it was just like, I'm just going to college so I can sit around and read books and, you know, do my thing. I would, like, never not leave my apartment for days on end, you know, just sitting there under stacks of books. And so I've always been kind of this self-made intellectual that used the accreditation sources that the state provides merely to, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess to try to have a professional persona as an intellectual or an academic or something. But even as a PhD now, it might be, from the perspective of my professors, it's always been a weakness of mine that I'm kind of a ghost in class, and then I write these really, really wicked, kind of really papers that are that have very little to do with the class content, you know, but that will take the question of the class seriously, but use my own sources to answer the question, that kind of thing. And then I kind of even did the same thing with the dissertation. And the dissertation on the ultras was really of my own creation, honestly. I mean, I had to have my advisors and the people that my professors that kind of guide you and, you know, put the hoops in front of you that you jump over. You know, they were there along the way, but for you know, for whatever inspiration, if it's divine or just being exhausted, they went along with my with what I was trying to do with my sources or with my theory and the, and bringing in Nietzsche and bringing in Sorel and bringing in, you know, crazy World War One military history and concepts and all these kind of things to talk about the ultras and talk about a dereliction from modernity and this and that. And
right.
You know,
now,
so
in your,
yeah, tell me.
Well, in your paper, I mean, at what point did you move from just being in like a sociological experiment or, you know, approaching it academically as an outsider, you know, or an infiltrator, you could say, for, you know, through the system, where, you know, at which point did you come to sympathize or identify with the actual feelings that were around you? You know, where did that happen? Was it early off, going in? How would you describe that process?
You know, it was I went into it with a certain amount of sympathy. You know, one of the beautiful things about anthropology is that it's extremely romantic, and it really has its origins in the romantic kind of movement in this kind of, I guess, not really high modernity, but pre-high modernity. And, you know, so most of the people that you meet, like the reason why a lot of these cultural anthropologists are these kind of weird, kind of tree-huggy, you know, bead-wearing, hippie-slash-Marxist-type people is that they all kind of get this same hard-on for what they study. And so, you know, so I don't know if they were not surprised that when they suggested that I start studying fascism and whatnot, that I was like, oh, you know, this is so freaking cool, you know, because I kind of came to it from an extremely postmodern philosophical position, which is really, really, I don't know if it's ironic or funny or even just totally predictable that I've returned in a lot of ways to those positions. You know, it's like, so you look at it from the far left, and you get shot through it, and then you look at it from a really, really far right position, and then you kind of, you know, you bring all this baggage together, and it just takes a while. It's like they lost half my luggage on the flight, you know, and so all this luggage is finally catching up with me. So it created a really interesting space for me right now. But, to stay on topic, I went into it very, very romantically and very committed to what, you know, to these guys, because I was already kind of a fan of the soccer team that, you know, in Rome, IC Roma, AS Roma, however you want to say it. And so, you know, I had to make contacts. You have to make some contacts before you go in the field. Otherwise, you're going to move to another country in another city, and you're going to be completely, you know, a fish out of water. So I had actually made contacts online, you know, God bless computers and whatnot. And the contacts really kind of vaporized on me very quickly, but I was able to kind of parlay it into others. And so it was like I went into it very committed to certain aspects of it. Politically, I was probably not quite prepared for what was going to happen to me. And I can't remember how I've addressed this in other interviews, which is one of the beauties of drinking red wine right before you go online to talk to someone. But my wife and I got to Rome, and we started meeting people and talking to people, and it just seemed really natural what they were saying to us. And it wasn't like we had to come home. Like, you came home talking about what we had experienced more as Americans than as a supposed scholar or as a person that had been kind of devoted to ultra-liberal politics and this and that. And so, you know, gradually, I don't even remember. Hell, you know, here, I'll do this. Let's pull out whenever I received the Zarathustra translation from Cambridge University Press. It was February of 2007. That's probably a little late, but let's say late 2006. By the time I was a couple, 2 or 3 months into being in Rome, I was more or less, I had gone native, let's say. And, you know, so I probably shouldn't say that too literally, in case there's anyone out there that might ever want to give me a job in academia, God forbid. But, you know, I had to have enough respect for these kids and for these men and women to be able to properly kind of defend them from the American Academy, let's say.
Right.
You know, most people... I don't think most research subjects, even in the Western world, understand the type of violence that's going to be done to them and to their kind of right to defend themselves from, you know, whatever we're trying to do, whether you want to call it globalization or multiculturalism or, you know, Americanization, liberalization, whatever it is. You know, these people just don't know because in a lot of ways they don't care, you know. I mean, they go out of their way to accommodate you as a person more than as a scholar. You know, I met plenty of people that didn't want to have anything to do with me, which is great. And the funny thing about it is most of those people were on the left. So, you know, the tale that I tell in my dissertation and what's going to become of the book that Arctos is going to put out, it's not accidentally rightist by any means, but at the same time, the glaring omission of any left perspective is not necessarily of my own doing. It was just that these guys, you know, that I had some taint on me by then. You know, I had kind of willfully shaven my head really for the first time, and right before I went to Rome. And
You didn't go into this whole thing as a brainwashed American, you know, who's guilty of his white privilege, and, you know, out there to try to show how evil and dirty the fascists are that want to preserve their culture and heritage. And, you know, you went in kind of neutral, and you were just... Are you Italian at all? Do you have an Italian background, or are you like a southern?
No, you know, my wife does. She's only, I guess her father is first generation. So she would be, I guess that makes her second generation. I can do math really well. So she has parentage from both Napoli and Catania, which for anybody that's an Italianist knows that Napoli and Catania are basically, Naples and Catania are the two armpits of Italy, which is really kind of funny because, you know, like an Italian something that might, that we might be able to discuss. I don't know how much details you want, but you know, they have their, they deal with their own version of what we call racism, and they call it regionalism. But the Napoletani and the people from, and the Catanese, the people from Catania, are basically the blacks and the Mexicans of the Italian spectrum, you know. So it's just funny that my beautiful little wife is the mother of our crazy, insane, badass son is this, you know, mixture of the worst bloodlines and the worst cultural lines, you know, according to the Italians, that you can have and still be Italian. But no, I'm straight Anglo, I guess. A lot of that stuff has never really been important to me, which is one of the cool things about how my life relates to my philosophical dealings and the things that I write, because I'm, you know, I've always been more of a narrative guy. So, you know, I attached myself to this kind of Latin experience, and certainly with the Romans and, you know, and most of this kind of Southern European thing. And if you've ever been to the continent or spent much time there, especially amongst radicals or amongst intellectuals, it's kind of a really interesting break between the continent and the Anglo tradition. And so I fall on this continental slash Latin tradition of my own kind of volition, and I really know quite little of this kind of waspy, you know, Anglo-American utilitarian approach to philosophy or thinking or life or whatever. You know, for me, I see all of it as an imposition on life in general, and certainly with the, with capitalism and its kind of role in the promulgation of multiculturalism, you know, it's something that I'm, you know, kind of very aggressively opposed to, let's say. So I don't even know. So I do this every time I have an interview, so I have no clue where I started on that.
Well, don't worry.
But no,
worry,
I was not neutral. Let me just say, I wasn't neutral at all. I was just unprepared, I guess. I was not neutral. I was very romantic. I knew a lot about, you know, the Italian, well, I guess what we would call the right in Italy. Not only because I had studied it in school, but because I had studied it on my own free time. So, you know, I was able to use all of that, you know, like I didn't go around to these ultras going, hey, man, Antonio Negri's like super cool, you know, because I didn't know enough about Negri and these guys and this kind of, you know, this contemporary far left in Italy to know. But I could go in and start talking about Roberto Fiore and Forza Nuova, and I could talk about, well, Casa Pound didn't really exist at that point, but, you know, I could certainly just talk to you in circles about Mussolini and the fascist regime and the history in Rome itself. And,
sure,
you know, so that was kind of endearing, and I was able to use that very, very, I don't want to say strategically, because it's never been a strategy for me, but I was able to use it in a way that it got people to accept my wife and I, as, or me and my wife, as individuals that really kind of passionately cared. And so let's say by December of 2007, I was in, you know. I mean,
we were part of
whatever families we needed to be involved in.
So they accepted you, you won their trust, and, you know, they took you in. I mean, you know, and by ultras, I mean, can you kind of define that? Is that a specific group? Does it intersect with, you know, because I've heard Casa Pound, Forza Nuova, I put pictures up of them.
Sure.
And I've heard of some other groups like the Northern League, different factions of things,
right.
And you know, I personally am interested really in those first two. Who were the types of people that you were engaged with over there during your stay?
Well, to answer the latter part first, the types were mostly, let's say, if you want to do a kind of a demography of the scene, we're probably talking somewhere between 17 and 40 years old, very aggressive, very boyish men, let's say. The types of men that you get the impression here that all grew up with younger or older brothers and that spent their days beating on each other and laughing about it. People that really had no fear of staring down police lines, probably what you would call bullies in some form. You know, and I use that term honestly for myself kind of as a term of endearment. You know, I'm obviously not involved with the demonization of bullying and this and that that the, you know, that our nanny state is involved in right now. But so, you know, as a type, though, very active, engaged guys and girls. The ultras themselves are kind of their own form of fascist gang, really, let's say. They don't always have to be involved in either the counter-liberal or even the liberal political forms of rightism in Italy, but they form their own they have their own kind of form of political engagement and political allegiance amongst themselves, simply because politics and soccer are very intertwined in Italy. So, you know, so you have groups, what they are basically, you know, most people know about the hooligan phenomenon. But in Italy, like in England, hooliganism has always kind of had this taint where it's more of a drunken kind of vulgar violence for the sake of let's just be drunk and go and beat each other up kind of thing. In Italy, it was always attached to extreme kind of parochial, local pride and what they call campanilismo, this extreme pride in where you are from and your roots and your people and this and that. And so the ultras will attach themselves, or they will form as an assemblage kind of organically based on what soccer team you follow. In most cities, you only have one team. You know, you have the team that represents your town. In the larger cities, I'll use the English thing as much as it pains me, but Milan, Turin, Rome, and I guess that's all, that these cities have more than one team. So, you know, you would attach yourself to whatever that team is within your city, and then that team you kind of represent as your city's team. So there's kind of a second level of attachment there that you do with symbols of your team with your town. But and then politically, a lot of times those two teams will be split between left and right. So in Milan, I swear I can't even say the word without saying Milano. You know, the Inter team is based on was always the team of the right, and AC Milan was always the team of the left, and in Torino would be the team of the left, and Juve would have been the team of the right, and kind of so on and so forth. So you get these things, and in Roma it was a little different. Maybe Roma itself, AS Roma, started as a team of the left, and Lazio was kind of the team of the fascist regime itself. So they've always had deep roots with the political right. But that's not to say that you don't get crossover from both. So a lot of normal bourgeois fans are political in a lot of ways anyway, like a normal American would be. You know, but for the ultras themselves, AS Roma's ultras, for the most part, is just as deeply of the right as Lazio's are. So you don't get a great political rivalry there, but you get a great symbolic rivalry, a rivalry that's based on the possession of the town and whose kind of symbols reign supreme. You know, so you get the imperial eagle on one side of Lazio and the Capitoline Lupa, the Capitoline She-Wolf on the other side. And, you know, so there's just great stories and great narratives and great, you know, bloodshed and laughter and tears on all sides of these divides. And, you know, and I met plenty of great Lazio people that knew what I was doing. And then I wore Roma colors almost every day I was there. And, you know, but these guys still knew that I adored everything that was going on, and they knew whose side I was on. If you broke it down ultimately between the ultras and these kind of, and the kind of normal bourgeois approach to sport and society, they knew where my allegiances were, you know, that I was willing to go along with a boycott of certain things, you know, as a person that had a season ticket in Curva Sud, in the, you know, where the ultras of AS Roma stood in the stadium. So, for me, even God forbid, now, what, 7 years removed or so? I mean, I left Rome in, God knows, in 2008, and I can't believe it's even been that long. You know, but for me, still, these guys are the epitome of who I'm trying to raise my son to be, you know, and they're kind of the answer to a lot of the questions that I still have about organization and about the possibility for some form of change or not, I don't know, not change, but a lot of the things that I wrote, let's just say it this way, that in order to stay out of trouble, and, a lot of the things that I wrote and write have these guys as my model, you know, because I know how much I was changed by, let's just say, the constant threat of interpersonal violence, you know, being around really aggressive, crazy dudes, you know, it changes your physiology. And so a lot of my work that I did, you know, in the dissertation and what I'm trying to do now with the book is to, or even that series of essays, you mentioned the Mussolini and the new fascist man, and that series of essays was kind of a, I don't know if it was how in-depth it was, but it was really a fun thing for me to just try to get some stuff out there for normal kind of people to see that, you know, your body is a really big part of what's going to happen, however far you can distance yourself from modernity and what's going on with us. Your body has to be front and center, you know.
I'm glad you make that point, because I think that gets lost on a lot of people in the movement. They tend to dwell in the realm of abstraction and, you know, like a theoretician and, you know, the realm of ideas. They forget that real practical politics is just getting off your ass and getting out there. And that's what fascism really was all about, is a philosophy of action over wards, you know. And this whole soccer hooliganism thing, I have to say, one part of me doesn't like it because it's a little disorganized, a little chaotic, but there's a huge part of me that loves it because of, you finally see some testosterone in European male, and you see like the ability to fight and just enjoy fighting and just living and being alive having that energy inside of you. So I mean, that's something I see lacking in us as a race right now, and something we need to rediscover. So I mean, where would you put, you know, the movement as a whole? When you look at your experiences in Italy relative to other countries, of course, we've all heard of the Golden Dawn and their success and other parties in other areas. You know, we mentioned Castle Pound and Forza Nuova. I mean, is there any organized, systematic, you know, gathering of folks in Italy or the Mediterranean that is on the rise right now? Would you say,
you know, other than what you've just said, I don't know of any personally. You know, the landscapes are so deep locally, and you know, even just in my couple of years as a researcher in Rome, there probably were no less than 15 different groups that were not necessarily trying to become mass movements. What they were trying to do was to tap into this kind of cultural inheritance that was available to either Romans or people that were transplanted to Rome. You know, these guys were very, very smart about being able to use their past and to create something new from it. And I get the impression, even with Golden Dawn, that it's the same, like when I, you know, you see these extraordinary, I have like a collection of photographs that I just, you know, drag into my computer. Anytime there was any of these demonstrations in Athens the last couple of years against the austerity measures when Golden Dawn kind of came to, they entered the public consciousness in the United States, and I'm looking at these guys, and I'm like, these are the same guys. This is basically the same energy. This is the same kind of organizational impetus. It's not a bunch of guys that are sitting around waiting for a dogma to be passed down to them from on high. These are dudes that are not willing to do that, you know, and that's how you end up in the street, you know. So I think the Americans, we've always – I think the Americans versus the Southern European experience, or at least the Italian experience that I know of directly – I know abstractly of the French and Spanish and the Portuguese and somewhat of the Greek experience. But, you know, but just to talk about what I do know, you know, the Americans just still seem to have, number one, an extreme kind of highly liberal approach to politics. Even our guys on the in the new right or on the far right still have a very liberal movement, mass-based approach to political action and political theory. So we are waiting for a messiah to come and bring the masses in, even if it's underground, and then we take over some, you know, create some space for ourselves and this and that, whatever the parameters of it might be. And you get the exact opposite approach in Italy, or certainly in Rome. Is what you get in Rome is two or three dudes that take it upon themselves to set up a little store shop type thing or storefront, or they, you know, set up a table in a piazza on a Sunday. And, you know, and they, like you said before, they just get out and they talk to people. And, you know, the right words stick with one or two dudes, and a few weeks later you've got three dudes, and then you've got five, and then you might not get any more than that. But you create a space in your community where people know what you're all about, and you know, a lot of these guys are really committed. Like Casa Pound originally was committed to doing these, they were like futurist circus type things, honestly. It was just these crazy shows where people would come in and they would put on demonstrations of, you know, that talking about futurism. And so a lot of it would just be lectures, but some other things would be music, or they would, you know, bring in basically anything that was going on in the culture or amongst the actual people there in the community, they would welcome, and you could bring it in, you know, and a lot of that, like for us, we're disconnected from that type of kind of grassroots, hands-on activity. And one of the things that I've kind of started to try to study for my upcoming either papers or book is this idea of inheritance. And you see it, just like I said before, you see it in normal kind of passive everyday life as a kind of private bourgeois citizen, and you see it in academic theory and academics as people. But this idea of inheritance has been completely wiped out of our kind of cultural memory. We have no idea. We think that inheritance is something that's floating through our blood, and this ephemeral, weird quality that's just floating in the air somewhere that we pick up on every now and then, when in fact it's something you have to grab with your hands and you have to get your hands dirty with what you inherit. Otherwise, you don't. Like, I have this little thing that I'm putting in the book at some point. You can't inherit what you don't learn, and you don't learn what you don't actually do, right? So it can't be an abstraction. It can't be anything other than what you actually do. And so when you start thinking about that and you go, okay, well, you know, how do I inherit Homer at this point? Well, it's not by sitting around reading. It's not by reading Homer, you know. It's by becoming some form of the warriors.
You have to paint your shield.
Absolutely.
Shield and get out. Yeah.
Beautiful. Absolutely.
Sure. I just wonder. I mean, you're so great to talk to because you've been in both worlds here. You understand American mindsets and politics, and you see the contrast over there. And you know, we're so disconnected from our roots. You know, we're so deracinated. It seems to many European nationalists here, or white nationalists, whatever word you want to use, that America is just a non sequitur. It's just impossible to even do anything here because not only, you know, when you subtract the conditioning process and the mass media and the education system and all the things that we have already against us, we're still working with a heavy deficit because Americanization itself has created this creature that is just completely at odds with tradition. It has no sense of blood or rootedness, or, you know, it's just all about money and just pop culture, and, you know, America really is just a void. So a lot of people kind of have given up, and they look towards Europe as being the, you know, the revival, the renaissance that's going to come. And I don't necessarily think that it has to be that way. I think there's plenty of great people in this country like yourself that understand what's going on and have a brain, you know, working in their heads that can actually do something for us. So, I mean, what are your views as to the potential future for trying to awaken a spirit in this country, even if it's not so connected to a new right tradition, even if it's only like a populism or a radicalism that has an American flavor to it, you know, because it seems like we're in a transitional period where, you know, the United States hasn't felt the pain yet, whereas over there they are going through austerity, so they can kind of merge the left with new right ideas as well. And, you know, in this country, people are still just, you know, blabbing on their iPhones and texting, and, you know, it's just all, people are just lost in the whole entertainment industry. So I don't know really if I'm even giving a question to you here, but do you think there's a possibility that we could experience the same type of romantic being swept away feeling that they have over there, only, you know, for Europeans who are transplanted in this country?
You know, there's a number of levels that I would say yes and no. On the most, to stick with the parameters that you've given us, I would say that what I want us to do is to start realizing that the ideas that we promote have never been kind of fashionable for a mass of people. Even if you look at what happened in Germany and Italy, you know, there was still a decent amount of materialism going on. There was a decent amount, like you're talking about austerity, you know. There's enough kind of material impetus going on that people are forced to come to certain realizations. Well, those types of realizations tend to kind of dissipate quite quickly whenever the conditions that led to their manifestation go away, you know. So I'm become quite skeptical of the idea that some kind of new right or some type of big T tradition can actually lead to a mass awakening. Because I just don't see those types of ideas ever being useful or even beautiful for very many people. And, you know, and so I'm looking at all this now, you know, having kind of been involved in it, not only, you know, just for a couple of years, really, which isn't long, you know, because there's so many guys that are kind of lifers with a lot of this stuff. And I come in and I go, well, I've got my background in Black studies and I stuck around for a couple of years and I'm already kind of getting bored. You know, but you know, I'm kind of started to back away from some of it, or at least kind of look at it through a more critical lens and say, you know, I think it's a weakness of ours that we want these ideas to be widespread, you know, or that we feel like they're a failure if they're not. And literally for me, I'm looking at it going, this is just modernity speaking through it. This is liberalization. This is a concept of liberal, mass-based, mobbish politics that we are incorporating, or we are throwing on top of Nietzsche, or we are throwing on top of Mishima, or we're throwing on top of Avalon, these guys that don't deserve it, you know. I mean, you have to climb to the mountain top to get Avalon, to get Nietzsche. You know, you have to start a journey that no one can join you on in order to truly understand what these guys were getting at and their deep, extraordinary, bodily, conceptual critique of modernity that they're giving us. And so when we turn around and go, well, we want to create a nationalist, a racial nationalist movement out of this stuff, well, you know, we don't, some of us don't see the problem in that, because I don't know why. You know, our instincts, their package, their assemblage of forces just doesn't allow that to happen. Now, the answer, another way that you would say yes to that is to say, okay, well, maybe we don't need a mass movement. Maybe what we need to do is realize that history's only ever been moved along by a small handful of people, you know, that these civilizational forces don't have to be mass forces, you know. Were they for the pre-Socratic Greeks? I mean, that's very difficult for us to say concretely because we know so little, but we know that Socratic Greece was an extreme critique of what had come before it. We know that Plato was reacting to something, right? So there's a great possibility that all of these beautiful things that we're given, I'm obviously partial to Sparta like most of our guys are, you know, but Spartans were not modern men, you know, and Sparta was not trying to conquer a continent or a world, you know. So we need to kind of maybe step back and say, okay, most of these people that we think that we're trying to reach that can't be bothered to turn off television are not worth fighting for, right?
Right.
So the racial paradigm gets us to think that we have to save a race. No, we have to save the right members of who we are.
Right.
Right.
But ultimately, you know, we have to be in it to win it. If we're just doing this for our own personal entertainment or, you know, just shits and giggles to try and, you know, just enjoy ourselves because it's a passion as an individual, to me, that's not what it's all about. What it's all about is taking our ideas and ultimately, if they're not accepted, forcing them through, you know, through the means of taking power. I mean, to me, it all comes down to power, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the masses have to embrace us. It just means that we have to be successful to a point that now we can change the direction that Western civilization is going in, and ultimately we may not be able to reverse the tide or the inevitable collapse of our society and cultural organic the organism that we are. But, you know, what matters is that in the end, our enemies are not running the show, and we are, and we can, you know, change policies and through politics. I mean, to me, that's got to be the end game. Otherwise, we're just really kind of just enjoying, you know, our own, you know, we're just playing our own ideals. I mean, it's not going to have any real significance in the world. So, I mean, what would you say to that?
Well, honestly, you know, the asshole-ish part of me would say, well, it's just extremely bourgeois, you know, to want to use politics or to use whatever the word that you just said, you know, as this kind of cudgel that we use to beat people, you know, to become part of our own regime. You know, but another way, I get what you're saying. I think for me what's happened is that I've started to there's two things. The early part of it is realizing how much free space there is in Southern Europe or in Italy or in Rome, space that the state does not reach, or space that capitalism does not reach. And the people have always done an extraordinary job of filling those spaces and keeping them smooth in Deleuzian terms. You know, they keep there's areas in your life that you inhabit every day that, like I said, the state doesn't enter. Capitalism doesn't enter. Well, you know, one of the reasons that family is such a big deal in Southern Europe is that they have these spaces. And family has always filled the void. The mafia was kind of the same thing. You know, the mafia filled a void that the state could not fill. So, you know, when you look at it theoretically or even as a person that's lived it, you see an extraordinary amount of personal responsibility and an extraordinary amount of local pride and local particularity and an extraordinary amount of beauty that happens on very micro-local levels. Theoretically as well, I've gotten, you know, I've fallen back into the philosophy of Gilles Deleuze, and Deleuze for most people on the far right would be this pariah because they think he's a leftist. And then most people on the far left think that he's a pariah because he's not left enough and this and that. And then you read it, and it's basically Nietzsche that's been updated for the late 20th century. And it's extremely inegalitarian, you know, it's this beautiful attack on anything that's universalizing and anything that overlooks the local, basically. And so,
who is
you know,
that?
I'm using these.
Who is that author? Just so.
D-E-L-E-U. Oh, hold on. Jesus, when I'm drunk, I can't even spell it.
Oh, you know what? No, you wrote. Yeah, I saw.
Yeah, the Deleuze papers. Yeah.
Yeah, you wrote something on that on Countercurrents. I saw a number of authors I was not familiar with myself. I mean, I know a lot of them.
That's a really great story. Tell me.
Yeah,
Tom.
I have to really dive into your work. I mean, we can talk about Marinetti. We can talk about Giovanni Gentile.
Yeah,
we can go anywhere you want to go with this. I basically was just trying to bring it back to the point that at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily have to be through politics that we take power.
Sure.
It can be
through
culture.
And let me say...
Go ahead.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, because Deleuze and one of his kind of best readers, this guy named Brian Masumi, I've never tried to figure out how to say it, came up with this idea through reading Deleuze about derelict spaces. And he theorized on these spaces that Nietzsche's philosophy would be one of them. It's this space, it's something in the world that is not useful to either a state or to an economic regime, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I wrote in those papers on Deleuze at Countercurrents that deal with how many of these spaces we've already carved out and how much we've created for ourselves. And even creating of your own home or your neighborhood bar or whatever it is, these spaces like tonight where you don't have to worry about somebody coming in and shutting you down because you say certain words or whatever. In certain ways, that's already an extreme dereliction. You know, having some form of pride in who you are and what you think your people are and this and that, that's extremely violent in this day and time. But what Deleuze tries to get you to do is to see how many of these spaces you already inhabit and how much freedom and how many moments of extraordinary revolution or extraordinary revolutionary potential you already possess, basically. And so, you know, for me in my home, you know, where we don't deal with the mass media, you know, I mean, I don't even know. Somebody said Lou Reed died the other day. I have no clue. I don't care. I don't know. And it's not that I'm completely apathetic to current events like a normal kind of myopic, stupid American would be that only knows about American Idol or something. It's just that I no longer let the news, I no longer let the TV think for me in any form whatsoever, right? So when you're talking about, you know, how to deal with, like you said before about, you know, this, all of these things that work against us, you know, well, when you create this bubble around you that you no longer allow our schooling or no longer allow the media or no longer allow American politics and all this kind of vulgar stupidity to impact your life, then it doesn't take very long, you know, a couple of weeks. It's just like when you move to another country and you have to speak the language on the spot. You know, it doesn't take long, you know, a few weeks, a month or whatever, and next thing you know, you're doing fine. You know, and you live in this cocoon because you no longer are watching CNN or whatever, and you realize that, my God, you know, none of that shit matters.
Mark, I just realized the Boston Red Sox are playing right now. We've got to cut this interview short. I have to go and watch some sports.
Yeah, sure. I don't blame you there.
You know, I love this idea of derelict spaces because really it's almost like they've created this void for themselves when I'm speaking in terms of the enemy the system. You know, it's like it's such a vacuum where there's so much freedom because no one's really paying attention. And it's funny because we can almost take over in the outward just by going inside, just by being more solipsistic and more internal and subjective and just pulling people that already agree with us and creating a little close-knit kind of faction, only you have to find a way to communicate beyond your small circle. You know, it has
to
transcend that. And then eventually, you know, we can spread through the internet, through met, through memes, just through multiple, you know, a number of things that we have at our disposal. You know, we can make it cool to adopt these ideas. If you think about leftists, they don't move into hardcore leftism right away. You know, they might start reading Michael Foucault or, you know, just any of the Frankfurt School critical theory thinkers before they end up, you know, reading some vicious anti-European bigot racist person out there who's a university professor. I mean, there's a number of them we can name, but
yeah,
I mean, it, you know, there's like a jumping off point or something like that. So there's a number of people. You don't have to jump right into Evola. We could have like little anchors out there, or you know, just little hooks, you know, just to pull people in. And once it becomes a social thing, that's why I think politics really, if you think about it, is a joke today. I mean, it's more about just doing things in a group setting that that have some kind of political message to them, whether it's overt or subliminal. And there's so much we can do in that area, you know, regarding fighting against our own dispossession. So,
you know, the only thing I would kind of just caution you on, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound fine.
Yeah, we started to get that little echo again, but, you know, I what I worry about, Dana, with a lot of our guys is that they are so content to be reactionary that they never stop and figure out how to affirm our own stuff, you know, and affirm, I mean, in this strict Nietzschean sense where the nobility acts on its own accord and for its own benefit without regard and in without definition, without meaning, without function in any way of the slave or the non-noble. And so it's a really beautiful, when you go through Nietzsche's work, it's a really beautiful kind of philosophical attack on how modernity makes us think, you know, where we have to engage the enemy or we always have to deal in some dialectical system where, you know, basically the cards are stacked against us already because most people are slavish by nature, you know. That's why they go along with just going to the mall and whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of guys amongst us that don't want anything more than what they've already got. They just don't want blacks or Mexicans involved, you know. And so for me, I'm kind of looking at it going, okay, well, what's at play here? What's really going on? Is there, you know, can we subdivide our species even further by something that's internal to the body of each individual or a part of our kind of makeup, you know, like people like me that have never known anything sacred enough that was I shouldn't say that, because Nietzsche for me is still untouchable. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff for me that, you know, there's nothing too radical for my liking, you know. And I've met guys through my work at Countercurrents that are the same way. And I've met other guys that find thresholds very quickly and turn back from them and you never hear from them again, you know. And, you know, so you start looking at it and you go, okay. I mean, there's certain guys that seem, you know, like another god that's wrapped up in a certain color skin or a certain type of animal skin is fine. And there's other guys that want to destroy every god that's ever existed or that ever will exist, you know. There's statists, there's nationalists, and there's other people that, like me, that want to destroy the entire rationale for a state, you know. So you get this kind of thing, and I'm going, all right, well, at some point, a lot of these guys don't need to be on the same team, maybe. I mean, maybe we do, maybe we don't. I mean, that's part of the fun of what we're doing is all of this is new and all of this is young, and it's ours, you know. So, again, it goes back to this idea of inheritance. I really want guys to start engaging more with what they are doing and not what they are reading and not what our history says about Lycurgus and our history about, you know, the sophists versus whatever and blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm into all that stuff, and I use it, very critically and use it as, you know, in my daily life. I mean, I'm raising a three-year-old that, you know, at this point knows no bounds as far as, what he's allowed to do or not to do or know or not to know or whatever. I mean, not to say he's a libertine, but, you know, he's
he's a 3-year-old libertine, you know, he's going out with the ladies. I mean, he's buying them fine wines and dinners.
Yeah, there's ponies involved. Yeah, you know, like he comes home with pony hair on him, and I'm going, I don't even want to know. But, you know, I mean, it's not that. It's that I have a test case. I have the opportunity to create the next generation of our people that might not necessarily have to have the taint that people like you and I have had to work through and try to get rid of. So, my point is, again, it goes back to this, like you had kind of fallen for this idea of derelict spaces. It goes into this thing where you have such extraordinary power to disconnect in a lot of ways. And it's just up to us to realize how powerful those disconnections are and what we can do with the energy that we find in ourselves that no longer has this overcoding process running through it,
right,
telling us who we are from our enemy's perspective.
The only caveat I would add to that is that once you disconnect and you internalize, you withdraw this power into yourself, I want you to explode it back outward.
Oh, sure. You
know, I mean, you can't just keep it, you know, inside your own little space. I mean, it has to go back. It has to be reflected back out. See, I'm the whole reason I'm doing these shows is because I realize that, wow, I've got a lot of these books. I've got a lot of this knowledge. I've taken in a lot of this, you know, personally, mentally, internally. But if I don't share it, if I don't get it back out there somehow, it's all kind of wasted on me, you know, and this is not about me. This is about us. But
just think about the victory that you've created of your own self, though. I mean, one person, you know, one Caesar, one Alexander, one Lycurgus, one Leonidas even, you can throw out all of these extreme rare examples of people that have changed the course of history.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying that's whatever, but don't discount. That's all I'm getting at. And I've kind of done the same thing you've done. I had the opportunity in a lot of ways to just be a normal academic and a normal college professor. I don't know if I still could. Honestly, I don't think anybody'd be crazy enough to hire me. I mean, I started sending in job applications that literally said I was trying to create an army to overthrow the state. You know, and the people would, you know, they write back these, oh, well, we looked at your application materials and, you know, it's not a good fit, whatever. So, you know,
Oh, man, you are awesome.
I mean, I did.
You know who you remind me of? Your voice. You sound a little bit like Keith Preston. Do you know Keith Preston?
Really? Obviously I know of Keith Preston, obviously.
A little bit of the Southern fourth generational warfare, it kind of reminds me of the derelict space kind of idea.
Well, sure.
Right, you look at Hezbollah, you look at the fact that in the future, the collapse of the state is going to be their salvation because it seems to me all their power really is an illusion. It's all a facade.
Sure.
You know,
beautiful.
The emperor has no clothes. Now we kind of just, you know, we can experiment. We can play around with things. We can say, all right, well, maybe I'll go over here. You know, you told me I can't say this, but maybe I'll say it anyway. I mean, and, you know, it just builds on itself. I mean, you know, it's like.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. And what I would only stress with guys, because I'm doing that, you're exactly right, and I'm kind of doing the same thing, you know. Is I want guys to not be so willing to just fall back in line for another state or for another master or for another god or whatever. You know, I want us to have this moment where we go, okay, you know, what do we need right this second, or what is going to be our new ethical position? We got to get rid of this morality. We got to get rid of all of this kind of, you know, biblical teleological approach to truth and to life and get more into, you know, becoming these really radical badass creatures that we could be, you know. you know, and the fourth generation warfare stuff is absolutely so prescient because that was the direction, you know, I've kind of almost been on a hiatus for almost a year now. And that's what I've been reading. I've been reading and dealing with guys, that have experience in this stuff, and I'm bringing in my crazy stuff, and they're bringing in their crazy stuff, and we're, you know, we're shooting things back and forth to each other that all of a sudden now become things that we can't mention on the air. You know,
it's just total insanity. You know, your crazy stuff, my crazy stuff. It's just a
But the way that they match up, you know, and the way that you know, and bringing this again, we go back to the physiological aspect. You know, there's plenty of guys that have gone off to war, you know, for Uncle Sam or for whatever, or for just themselves to go and do it in whatever context this modern world allows, and they've been transformed, and they come back, and they don't, you know, they don't. There's nothing in this world still. It's like post-Vietnam. There's nothing in this world on a day-to-day basis that allows you to celebrate what you became in war, right?
And what I'm trying to do
is kind of go, no. Don't buy into the idea that you just turn this stuff off and you go and get a clerk job somewhere. You know, we got to use this stuff. You learn this stuff for a reason. It wasn't, you know. It might not have been to protect Uncle Sam. It might have been for another reason altogether.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
just,
why I say,
just to leave it unsaid.
I say one of our main target populations should be ex-military people. People
Absolutely.
Who have been in the services, and they kind of already have some good instincts in them. Now, they may have been tricked. They may have been manipulated. Sure. I mean, today it's unfortunate that the propaganda is so pathetic. I mean, it's like... Really, I mean, the things that gets people to fight and die for this country are kind of laughable when you really look at it, which makes me think that I think most of these people are doing it for money. They're just mercenaries, and, you know, they go into the services because it's a job, you know, and that's and that's dangerous. If you really look at it, that is dangerous for them because that shows that they really don't have any true loyalty to the government for which they are fighting for. They're only there as a condition of elevating themselves in society. And once they have no more invest in that society, which clearly hates them and is designed to destroy them as a people, as a folk, they might just turn. They might flip. And these people should be our number one target of recruitment. And you know, it's definitely something – I mean, we probably shouldn't really go too – We shouldn't talk about it on the air, but I mean, it's
well, just keep it abstract.
Important.
We can,
yeah,
you know
yeah.
what? Let's do. We can just mention the idea that the fascist movement started with the main cadre of guys were former RDT and former World War I infantrymen that, you know, came back to Italy or that, you know, came back from the war front and had no, they had no purpose. You know, the state couldn't use them, and they didn't disband necessarily. And they kept their weapons, and they, you know, just bided their time. And next thing you know, they started something that changed the course of 20th century history. So,
right.
Yeah, keep it abstract, and I think we'll be fine. You know, I think for our listeners and for guys like us, we need to know that these guys are out there, and I know that they're out there because I talk to them. And in fact, I'm, you know, writing a book with one of them, and we're, you know,
great.
It's
killer, man. That's killer.
It's a really, but you know what, Dana, the thing is that it, like I approached a lot of the stuff romantically about military service, just as you just did about, well, a lot of these guys are doing it for the money or they're doing it for whatever reason. And I always, a lot of these guys will correct me and say, you know what, dude, that's all irrelevant for us. For a lot of the dudes that we need to focus on, we're doing it for nothing more than themselves, to know that they could do it, right? For good or bad, they know what they're going to do when the shit goes down, you know, to be
right.
Vocal about it. And
right.
That is a similar approach to life that these ultras have on a much lower level, but at least they knew as a group of guys who was going to stand on the front line and who was going to, you know, cower behind. Now, obviously, in a group of five or six dudes, everybody's on the front line or you're not in the group anymore, you know. But it's still that same approach and dedication to each other and dedication to life and whatever you're doing or dedication to the thrill. I mean, even if it is something that's ephemeral and something simple that's fleeting, it still happens, you know. And so I would talk to my dudes and I would say, okay, well, you know, how do we get this stuff to turn on and not switch off? And they go, well, it's very difficult because you get guys, you see guys turn on in the moment of battle, you know, and it only lasts for a minute and a half, and then they turn right back off, and they can't tell you how it turned on or how it turned off or what the deal
something,
was.
Something just but, made them go berserk, you know.
Yeah, like, something yeah. happens, and something heightens your awareness, and something becomes, you know, comes over. It's that Michael Jordan thing, I guess. I don't know what it is. You know, for guys like us that have never truly experienced it, or I can't speak for you, but for guys like me, you know, it's still something elusive.
Well, I think it's a fight or flight kind of thing. You know, it is physiological in a sense, but it's applied in the abstract because we are really facing doom. I mean, this is if something doesn't change very quickly. Now, look, we may all die out. The human race may die out, but the sun is going to burn out at some point. I mean, I have this whole internal struggle with myself over why do I even care. I mean, you know, I mean, it's, you know, what is it that makes us want to preserve our culture or our gene pool or our people? I mean, in the end, what does it really matter? You know, I have that nihilistic impulse in me as well, and it certainly doesn't help things when you have a society around you that encourages you to kind of just self-destruct. It's already embedded in the culture. So, you know, I just... I tend to think that, you know, I'm doing it as part of it is reactive. You talked about being reactive. And if you think about it, the inner rebel in me just hates society for what it is. Now, I'm not saying I would just rebel. I'm not rebelling for the sake of it. You know, I truly do believe in the ideals that I have. But, you know, because I feel that it's just right and natural and pure and just everything that was meant to be. But, you know, also, it does feel like it's kind of fun to just kind of stick your middle finger up at society, you know, and tell them, look, I know you want me dead. I know you are trying to genocide my race or my people. You know, I see what you're doing. I see this subtle, you know, manipulative agenda that you have, and I'm just going to stick my middle finger up to you and do it in any way I can. I mean, and that's kind of like the rebel in me that just wants to do that. Now, if society was healthy and something I could get, you know, on board with, maybe I would be a conformist. But right now, I just can't. I can't do that because it's just it flies in the face of everything that, you know, my whole being. So,
yeah. You know, I think what's cool in talking to you is that you have a lot of the same energy that I have in a lot of the same concerns. Now, what I started to do really, I mentioned something about a second level something or another earlier, but you get these, I'm off to like a second level critique where I've started to try to figure out the content of new right narratives and these narratives of kind of counter of modern thinking and this narrative that we have that wants to counter the genocidal impulse of late modern, you know, Western civilization and whatever. And, you know, so I don't know, man. I don't really know exactly how to move from one to the other. You know, it's still something I'm working on in my kind of moment of silence. But, you know, I would just say that we don't just be very conscious of where you kind of are in your thinking as far as, you know, this impetus to reach out or to attack or whatever. Now, I'm not the attack part, but like you say, you know, like you couch this in terms of reaction. And for me, it's not that big a switch to be sitting totally in the active and affirmative side of what we're trying to do. You know, I mean, I think that it's probably more of a slow burning process, but one of the things that has happened that I kind of realized with me and now with trying to raise my son is that when you get to this stuff and you do it for your own purposes, Dana, like when you're not worried about, well, I have to, you know, create some message that a lot of people can understand, what you do is you create something of yourself that is untenable, that there is something in you that will no longer submit, right? And you become a creature that is no longer useful and no longer functional in this bourgeois modern society, you know, and the terms of the society no longer make any sense. The truth-making or the truth or sense-making apparatus that we are given no longer has any value or purchase for you. And you cast it off and you become a creature of another species, honestly. And, you know, and that to me becomes far more interesting for other people. You know, like I talk to people now at the grocery store, if somebody, you know, because I'm a very likable guy for some reason, even though I'm just a kind of natural curmudgeon. And people, like, want to ask me questions about stuff, you know. And
he's
I go,
a cool
oh, you know,
fish.
Yeah, right, you know. And
people want to
so
get to
I'm,
know, you know, it's like.
Yeah. It's like the grimace and the shaved head and the fascist imagery and all this stuff. It just doesn't, you know, and the sound-canceling headphones and the sunglasses and this whole thing, and people just can't bother. They can't help themselves with the tapping on the shoulder, you know. The white power T-shirts that are, you know, veiled kind of messages and this and that. And so, you know, but people come to me and I go, oh, well, you know, I have a militia. You know, I start telling them, I'm in a militia now, and they just go, oh. And I do that every now and then, and sometimes people go, oh, dude, I know some guys you should meet. And then I go, oh, okay. You know, so it's like at some point.
So easy.
When you step off the soapbox in a lot of ways, you know, I'm not telling you to shut down your network and do all this stuff, but I'm just saying it's like at some point the right people are going to hear what we are saying regardless of how many of them are out there, you know, and I've had thousands of people read my stuff at Countercurrents, and I've had probably five or so really true readers, people that I've stayed in contact from day one, honestly. And some of these dudes are really wicked, nasty, smart dudes. And they're really wicked, nasty, violent dudes. And they're really wicked, nasty, badass people that I'm now trying to learn from that I only found from writing a silly little essay on, you know, on paganism without swords or something, you know. And so the people are there, you know, and it's not like for me now, like, I guess my only point is I'm not necessarily trying to add to the bunch, you know. What I'm trying to do is to kind of maintain relationships with the right group of guys that don't try to hold me back in any way in what I say or do or whatever, and that,
yeah,
you know, and we'll create our own network at some point. I mean, you and I are talking tonight, and we this is all very abstract. I mean, we have these forces at our disposal already. I don't know if we need to rush necessarily.
Let me tell you something, man. Of those five people, I'm one of those five people, man. I've been following you, and, you know, I think we are, like, on the same plane of existence here. And, you know, I really, man, you are just so dangerous to the system. I can just see it. I can feel it because, you know, you can relate on many different levels. You know, and the fact that you're a person who went to college in the United States and is a black studies major talking
about
Mussolini with me right now. I mean, this is just like it's on another planet, and it's the last thing that they would expect. It's like a curveball with a hook and a dip, you know, and they don't know where to go with this kind of thing. And you're a very out of the box thinker. I can see that. And as far as reaction goes, you know, part of me says, all right, being reactive in a sense is bad because you might just be reacting for the sake of it. You might not really believe what you're doing. You're just belling to go against it. But I really believe what I stand for. And, you know, I mean,
what I mean more than being reactive as far as just lashing out is allowing your opponent to create the terms of the engagement.
Oh,
I mean more so. So, you know, like a lot of – that's why I've become very kind of skeptical about racial nationalism, because race and nation were both created by our enemies, basically. These are high modern concepts. Now, whatever we want to add to them, well, no, we're talking about the people, and we're talking about blood and soil and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you can rationalize it any way you want, bro. But these are concepts that did not exist in this world in any form until the already well-established degeneration of the cultural processes of whatever people we are trying to uphold as our own. So that being said, now that was the idea of reaction. Now, and I can't remember where I was going to go with number two, but we, you know, as a person that's a scholar, I mean, I certainly appreciate that your enthusiasm and your kind of endorsement of what I'm trying to do, you know, because the academy is really scary. I mean, I don't know how much time you've ever spent in it, you know, but it's a nasty thing that this idea of freedom of speech. I mean, I know what I was going to say. It's like if I was assassinated tomorrow, I would not know if the bullet came from the left or the right, you know. And so I kind of look at that nowadays and I go, you know what, that means I'm actually on to something. I'm doing something right. I'm actually trying to push the ideas that we are able to use past these boundaries that are so kind of wrapped up in the world that we're trying to defeat, you know. And it's very difficult to defeat your enemies who are well-suited to this world and this form of warfare with their own weapons.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, you know, I'm going, okay. Now, how many more books, honestly, how much more stuff do any of us need to read, right? I mean, are we really just waiting for that one thing? I mean, I hope so, because I'm trying to start sell some books pretty soon. You know, I'm hoping that I can reach one more dude. But it's like for most of us, we've read, like you said before, you've got all this knowledge, you've got all this information, and you want to share it. A lot of us have this information and this knowledge, and we still aren't doing anything with it. We're not doing anything about it. And I guess I'm still not myself. I mean, I look at the world, and I get antsy, and my wife has to go, you know what, you've got a wife and you've got a son that you have to raise, and you need to be responsible, and you need to, you know, to be responsible to us and not do anything stupid. You know, you don't need to die in prison or to die in a firing squad and buried in a shallow grave behind some governmental building just for the sake of your pride or something. You know, like you said before, I mean, we got to do this and we got to be smart and we got to think about, you know, transgenerational action. And, you know, so again, you might reach
right
one or two dudes, you know.
You know what,
and they might
you know,
raise
you
their
actually, I've got a really close friend, Wolf CT, out there. He's got a wife and a, you know, a family. He's got two kids. And that really changes your whole perspective on things. It may make you want to fight harder because now you see progeny. You see what you see the shitty world that you're leaving your children to. It may make you want to really fight harder. But on the other hand, you have to be a little more conservative. You have to make sure you're not too crazy, you know. And as somebody who doesn't have kids, I have less to lose, you know. I mean, I don't have take care of anybody. So that is something that does go through my head. Is, you know, trying
to... Are you
to
planning on having kids one day, Dana?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the purpose of...
How old are you? Are you allowed to say how old you are?
I'm 30, so...
Oh, dude, I got 13 years on you, bro. Right? 13 years. That's a lifetime. So you got plenty of time. But, you know, and again, Dana, one of the cool things, are you married yet?
No, man. I broke up with my girlfriend going out for 5 years, so... You know, I mean,
was she aware of your politics?
She was, and she was tolerant because she came from a background. You know, she was actually pretty genetically close to me. She was like a quarter Italian, quarter different European groups, and half Armenian. And on the Armenian side, she actually had a family that was pretty aware of the whole Jewish issue. And that actually, we had an understanding there. However, they were really worried with my radicalism. They were worried about, you know, well, what about when you go to get a job? You know, aren't you going to get fired? Can't they hold this against you? You know, and so, I mean, they have a very, it's interesting, it's just studying them as a people, the Armenians. You know, I knew of them, because I have a quarter in me that is Middle Eastern. It's not Arabic. It's a similar group to Armenians. And if you see how they function tribally and how cohesive they are, you know, I mean, this is the answer. I mean, you wonder why, you know, how this subversive group took over Western civilization. They did it through the unity of ethnic loyalty, and that's how, you know, that's how something that just modern Americans don't understand. They've been fed a bill of lies that, you know, we're all just people. We're all just human beings. I mean, we're all just the same at the end of it, and we all bleed red, you know, and they have no idea how the rest of the world functions. And, you know, so she wasn't against me, but she wasn't for me. And that created this little tension and conflict. And I don't want to go too much more, but we do have a caller here, and I wanted to open it up to callers. Is that okay with you? Because we've got about a half an hour left until we go into overtime. I don't want to hold you too much past that. It's a 661 caller. So I'm going to bring them up, see if they wanted to ask you anything.
Great.
And the number here to call is 347-633-9657. We're having a very engaging, intelligent discussion with Mark Dial. And is that how you pronounce your name?
Yeah, Dial.
All right, Mark Dial, like dialing, you know, a phone call. So
yeah,
I'll pull them up here. Let's see if they have anything to ask you.
Dialing for dollars?
661, what's your name and where are you calling from?
Oh, it's Bob in D.C., Wolf Wall Street.
Oh,
I was going to come in on attack mode, and then I just continued to listen to this guy. And, yeah, it's a lot of sense there, a lot of total sense there. And
us what you want to do, attack.
Oh, no, that was my initial reaction. It was a reactive mode. I don't want to get into the intellectual stuff, man. I think you've been there, and I think you're trying to get away from that. That's what I hear. That's what I really like. I really like what I'm starting to hear as I listen more. I think you know what I'm talking about. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
but,
we do. Don't worry.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, Dana, you mentioned I won't go into that. In fact, I'm getting a little old, and I'm starting to lose my train of thought here because I didn't think I'd get on top of the queue so fast. But I got to say this. The most important thing that we all have to understand, old, young, it really in the scale of time, near time, grandchildren, children, grandparents, great-grandparents, and progeny the other way. This is a long-range thing we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long-range thing. The Kaijus have planned, whether they did so covertly, overtly, you know, officially, or just with their paradigm. They've been planning this crap for a long time. And now they're near the top, and they're losing like mad, but that doesn't mean we're winning. The thing is, this is a generations-long fight we've got in front of us. And what my bottom line at this particular moment in time is we got to, and I've said it many times before, it's nothing new, we got to keep on keeping on and knowing that that's right. Don't go and put yourself on the line when it don't matter. But when it matters, put yourself on the line.
Yeah, well said. Are you there? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry. Well, everything went silent for a second. No, that's beautifully spoken, and that was one of the things I was getting ready to get at with Dana, with talking about children and talking about being married. Is the, you know, we need to be laying foundations. You know, yes, obviously we would all love to be on the front lines of this war that we, you know, lay in bed dreaming about. But more realistically, as you say, this is something that is a war that is extremely winnable within a few generations, honestly. Because, you know, as Dana was just saying, too, about, you know, the forces that our enemies use, what they are really doing is separating from ourselves what we are capable of. You know, they're not ganging up on us and turning us into weaklings as much as trying to convince us you know, through morality, through their truth, that we don't need to do these things, or that we should be ashamed of having the capability of doing these things, when in fact our history shows that we have an extraordinary ability to shape the world. And so, you know, and again, I'm not saying that all of us do, but the right ones will. And, you know, the right ones is who I'm trying to focus on at this particular moment and who I'm trying to create in my own household. So, yeah, keep it up, man. You're exactly right.
Yeah, the only reason we're here is because they were there.
There you go.
Yeah, you know what? Wolf, I actually, this is my whole approach to the Jewish thing, is that we shouldn't necessarily look at them as a bad thing completely in themselves, because the way I look at them is that collectively, if we didn't have them to oppose us, we wouldn't be able to have something to overcome, you know, evolutionary as an obstacle. You know, it's almost like you don't get a free pass in evolution. You have to fight. You have to adapt, you know, and there's going to be things coming along that, you know, it's not an easy ride, and they certainly don't make it an easy ride for us. I mean, so I think, you know, we shouldn't necessarily completely, you know, look at them as just something that is, I look at them as, they're just put there to oppose us because that's their nature, because we have clashing visions, clashing, you know, ideologies, and it's just a matter of us awakening to who we really are. I mean, if we can manage to this war of attrition, it's all a war of ideas right now, and who is really stopping us from waking up? It's just ourselves. I mean, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly.
You run your own household. You run how your children, you know, the perceptions and the way that they process the world and information. And they might reject you. They might accept it. But for the most part, I've seen plenty of people manage to raise a family in today's horrible society and modern culture, a total defiance of that. You know, I mean,
sure.
So it can be done.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing, both of you guys. Whenever you, like we were saying early on, when you create this derelict space where the, you know, where, like, I don't know, movies, sports, all this stuff. I mean, some sports I know, but I don't, like, these guys no longer have any, they don't weigh on my mind. They don't factor into how I think about myself or the world or my child or whatever, because I've completely removed them from the equation. So, you know, the whole Jewish question thing for me now is it's not to say it's irrelevant, because I understand these kind of civilizational forces, and I'm a Nietzschean, so there's no, you know, you can't get around how the slave revolt started, you know, so to speak. You know, but as a person, to me it's almost laughable. I mean, I don't we just need more guys that shut off from that, and, you know, and that don't let them have any power, and don't let them hold sway, don't let them think about, you know, have any critical kind of impetus in their or kind of energy in their lives. And then when they step to you, you laugh it off, you know, just like you said before, you give them the finger. And then what are they going to do? When they realize that you don't buy into the narrative any longer, when the morality no longer has any force, then they can't deal with what we're actually talking about that we leave unspoken.
Now, never underrate the manipulative power of the Kike Jew. It has a heritage of thousands of years. It will sneak in under the tent that you thought was protected. The camel's nose will be under that tent, and that will be the Kike Jew, and you will not even see it coming.
You know what's ironic about that term too? I think I could be wrong here, but from my readings and studying, when Jewish immigrants were coming to the United States, there was a clash between German Jewish immigrants and Russian Jewish immigrants. The Germans the German Jewish immigrants were well more established in the whole banking sector and the entire, you know, establishment of the country, and they kind of looked down a little bit on the more Eastern European ones, and that whole term comes from them making fun of themselves. I could be wrong about that, but I thought it was an Eastern European designation for them. But, I mean, basically for me, the whole complicated matter, it only comes to reality in the sense of life and death struggle. You know, we have to bring this from the abstract back into the blood. Like to me, it's and ideas play a big role in this because, you know, somebody might be a liberal and they don't even know why they're a liberal. I mean, they don't understand where their ideas came from. They don't realize that they've been conditioned to believe such and such. And, you know, I mean, this whole idea that race doesn't exist, yet, you know, white people are a racist group that wants to dominate the world, and we've oppressed everybody, and we put people into slavery, and, you know, it's just all this negative PR. But on the same token, they love to just engage in the fruits of Western civilization, all the technology,
Dana,
all, yeah. I mean,
Dana, if we really, really, I mean, down deep, really wanted to dominate the world, we would dominate the world. That's not in our heart and soul. That's not in our genetics. We want to get to the next level, to the stars, really. And that's what these other monsters and their subordinate Sanskalat underlings don't understand. They can't understand. They're incapable of understanding the higher level of creativity. And that's all there is to it.
Well, Mark, let me ask you, while I got you guys both on the line. Mark, what do you feel? Obviously, you're a Nietzschean. So I'm going to assume, I'm going to make a very safe presumption here that you are pretty anti-Christian. Now, we have a huge segment in the racialist movement that is so caught on with Christianity. They can't let loose that attachment. You know, they look at Charles Martel. They look at the Crusades. They look at the history. And, you know, it's a huge part of their identity that they can't dissociate the two concepts from each other. But to me, when you mentioned the slave morality and the slave revolt, I mean, Christianity was the first Bolshevism, if there ever was one. I mean, it really, you know, so how can these people look at what they, you know, this religion and try to synthesize it or, and it's funny because fascism was really very Catholic. I mean, you look at the Mussolini, you look at Franco, you know, Portugal, a lot of different areas, you know, there was that Catholic element, but that's why I like National Socialism so much more than fascism, because it had that pagan essence to it. So where do you fall in this whole area? And then we're going to go to a quick break, and then we're going to open it to other callers who want to ask you anything. So,
well, you know, Mussolini and his placation of the Catholic tradition in Italy is kind of up for debate. You know, some people will talk about it as if, you know, the Catholic imagery and liturgy and all these things were really informative of fascism, and other people will talk about it more realistically and say that, well, you know, he's dealing with a particular populace with a frame of mind that I'm saying that, you know, the Italian state has more or less been empty for however many hundreds of years, if you're even just talking about from the creation of the Italian state in the 1860s, the church filled a mighty void. So Mussolini knew that he couldn't come in lambasting the church, you know, and still win over these people, and also win over the liberal apparatus that the church had set up. So Mussolini, in a way, is very conniving and is very smart politically to know who he has to align himself with in order to kind of win this war against the communists and the socialists and whatnot. And then another thing for me personally, man, it's probably not something I'm going to win over many fans with. If you're saying that, you know, that there are a lot of dudes that are still stuck on Christianity, to me, those guys are conservatives that are playing with new right ideas, but they'll always be conservatives. And number two, it's like I said before, some guys need a god. Some guys need some shining example to give their life meaning because they can't look at life on its own terms. And those guys will be the ones that will maintain an attachment to a Jewish religious sect. So, you know, they can talk about the Jews and they can talk about the destruction of modernity all they want, but as long as they walk around with their little Bible and preach morality and preach a teleological vision of historical process and method and a democratic approach to politics and a whatever else is in there, then, you know, they're probably not going to be frontliners, but we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to denigrate people and what they're trying to do. But you read my stuff and you know where I stand on it. I mean, I think you
and I would both recognize if some person who was of a Christian background and he was a racialist or, you know, a tribalist, I mean, and, you know, he manages to synthesize these ideas together and in a real way where he's an active person that is willing to get out and engage and fight and struggle. I mean, I would have nothing against that. And I don't really try to push people away who are of that persuasion. I just try to make it known that, look, we're going to clash when it comes to the abstract realm. I mean, if we're going to debate these things, you know, we're going to have an issue. If we can get past that, then great. But you have to know where I stand. I want to be honest with you. I hate Christianity. I think it's the downfall of our people today. And, you know, I mean, Wolf Wall Street on the line here, he talks about the psychological immune deficiency problem that we have. I think Christianity is a huge part of that.
Absolutely. to finish each other's sentences.
Absolutely. So, I mean,
yeah,
I'm gonna quick sign it so you can get a drink
okay.
or you can relieve yourself, whatever you need to do, get another glass of wine. You know, and it'll be a quick 4 minutes. This is a band out of Italy called Nonifer. The song is called White War. We'll be back in 4 minutes, and we'll be going a little bit into overtime probably. If anyone wants to call and ask you a question, the number is 347-33-9657. We'll be back in a few. Okay, we are back. I don't know who's on board with me. Anybody with me?
I'm here anyway.
Comradin, yes, okay. You know, it's funny, I just got into a big argument with somebody on Facebook over the word comrade. They were, you know, comrade is a Bolshevik term. We can't use comrade, you know, it has to be something else. And, you know, it's just, I just find myself like, why do we engage in these little tedious discussions? It seems like, you know, this lack of fighting the real enemy makes us it makes us turn on ourselves, this internal struggle.
Daniel, they're looking for reasons to escape.
That's it. Escapism, right. I think that this whole racialist movement, they need to leave the escapism behind. They need to face reality head on and realize that this is not going to be this is going to be the biggest epic struggle that we've ever faced in history. And we have faced some tremendous odds in the past, but we absolutely gain inspiration from our forefathers and move forward. I mean, this is, we have to lose this fear of death. And I think that, whatever religion it is that you pull from that makes you not fear death, that's what is going to take us forward. It has to be a religious, a spiritual thing. It has to transcend politics. It has to be something. Go ahead.
I hate to butt in here, but folks will just go to my show on Sunday, 85857 TalkShoe, and when Frank came in at about 52 minutes, I got to it. I never really meant to get to it, but that's where you got to go to really find out to get to that higher level of thinking. And I believe me, I'm an old guy, and it took a long time to really meld, not that I know this, but that I'm ready to expound this to other people. And it's pretty simple stuff. It's pretty simple stuff, but it's profound. You've got to get to a higher level, and then the way I put it there, I'm going to tell you right now, the way I put it there, even if the entire life force of the planet Earth, even if the planet Earth is completely destroyed, I have not lost my beings.
Well, Mark, what is your feeling on the individual soul, the race soul, traditionalism? See, this whole traditionalism thing, there's a part of me that loves it, and there's a part of me that hates it. I like a lot of the concepts and the kind of flirtation it has with new ideas, but I find that a lot of these people are just way too intellectual. Like they don't understand the gritty reality of it. They don't get their hands dirty. It's all just these concepts, a lot of reading, and you know, I don't know. It's just too much reading, kind of dulls the senses. You know, I mean that's
I guess for me to be able to say that is quite a critique of reading, since I'm kind of a born voracious reader. But yeah, there's no doubt that what you find with it is more of an ascetic, an instinct to close yourself off from the world with a stack of esoteric or sacred texts and engage with those texts and leave the world behind. You know, and I have the same critique myself. I want to tread lightly with it because some of my greatest supporters are traditionalists, and not that I want to just pander to their support, but I sincerely try to respect what they're still doing because I don't do it myself. But I probably share the same critique with you. You know, that was really what went into these kind of early papers that I wrote about Walter Otto and looking at kind of these bourgeois pagans that, you know, that think that you can read a book, you know, and then put on some costume or regalia and go about your normal life and think that you somehow, you know, rebirth some form of paganism. And it's it's quite disturbing that people don't change any of their ethical content, or they don't critique the thinking that goes into creating a modern person, you know, at the same time that they dress up in these costumes. So the dress up for me is great. I mean, I dress up every day. I'm a clothes whore. You know, I wear camo and black stuff, and I don't leave the house without some form of get up, you know. But my get up is, you know, has some serious type of kind of conceptual, you know, radical break with modernity attached to it. So,
Mark,
you know,
let me ask you.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
What was your opinion of the movie Fight Club? I found that that movie had a lot of fascist undertones to it. I found that it was very existentialist, very futurist, some Marinetti themes in there. You know, it really kind of spoke to the white male and the situation that the white male has been put in modern liberal bourgeois society, where we have to kind of really fight against their own instincts. We have to become effeminate. We have to really, you know, it was just this
right.
this outrage where, you know, it really, to me, was saying a lot of things that we would like to express at a subliminal level to the masses. And it wasn't racial at all, but it really easily could be, you know, co-opted into that message. Even William Pierce's Resistance magazine had an article on that movie. What do you think of Fight Club?
You know, I love Fight Club. Honestly, I'm still a big fan of the movie. I have, you know, a nice hardcover first edition of the book. I have an audio book copy of the book that I listen to sometimes at the gym, and I'm still convinced that the movie's better than the book, but at the same time, I'm convinced that Polyanuk is how I say his name, but that he was on to something that we are still, as you said, that he was on to something that he might not have wanted to be on to. I don't know, you know, but the movie is an extraordinary expose of what we have become and what we are fighting, especially within our bodies. And, you know, you can read Georges Sorel, and Sorel has amazing stuff, amazing, really pithy Nietzschean-type things about bourgeois prohibitions against violence that ended up forming a lot of postmodern and post-structuralist theory on the state and ideas about how the state has to have a monopoly of violence. You know, and so the Fight Club phenomenon, the Ultras phenomenon, these things coincide in the fact that they show you how transformative in life violence and it can be. You know,
this is why I celebrate skinheads. I mean,
Sure.
There's a part of me that dislikes them because I don't like seeing brawling, you know, just without a purpose. I like violence that has a purpose to it. I don't like it just when it's, you know, you looked at me the wrong way. To me, that's kind of very subhuman. You know, it's got to have some higher meaning to it. But maybe I'm wrong in that respect. I don't know. But
well,
I bring it up.
Been in a fight, maybe.
I bring it up because I think that we really need that. We really need that because we've come to a point where society is so sensitive, this hypersensitivity, this PC multicultural world that we live in is like, to me, it's almost like it's an admission that they've created something that's a monster. They've created something so unnatural, something where we have these feelings just that want to burst from the seams. We have you know, it's just like a volcano underneath, and it hasn't come out yet as a collective, but it is there, and you see signs of it everywhere. You see these outrages where whether it's this or that, I don't want to even say, but you know, it's so abstract yet so real, yeah.
Yeah, and what I keep using this term assemblage, and assemblage is a really powerful concept counter to this modern idea of community, because community wants us to have some higher meaning to congeal, you know, or some set of moral principles that we would all supposedly need to buy into in order to congeal, whereas assemblage takes into consideration that we will assemble for reasons that we might not understand and that these connections will be there regardless of our consciousness of them. Well, one of these things about assemblage is you would look at is you would say, okay, you've got this derelict space, you've created this blockage with modernity. If you have this form of interpersonal violence as part of your assemblage, it will attach itself to a shite ton of other areas or other aspects of how you live. So if you have no, you know, moral prohibition against violence, and you've got a prohibition against morality, and you've got an extreme form of ethics and a camaraderie amongst men, and you've got, you know, all these other things that would fit into all this that Jack Donovan talked about so eloquently in his books, then you create an instinctual setup in the body. You create some physiological realities that, like I said before, that you become useless to the modern, enslaved, last man, you know, good kind of moral Christian, you know, civic conscious duty, whatever, liberal person. You literally, it's impossible to think the thoughts that you used to think is basically what happens. And this goes back to how we started today in getting at some aspect of my transformation, what really happened to me in Rome. It wasn't so much that I changed my ideas. It was that I saw how much the ideas have to do with what my body was being forced to endure or, you know, even in a thrilling or joyous context, you know. So, you know, this idea that, what Fight Club is pointing to, the transformations that Fight Club is pointing to are so much deeper than what the political realm can deal with in this form of life. It's so much deeper than the quote-unquote cultural realm can deal with, simply for the reasons that we talked about before, because most people think, you know, assume that culture is something that's not taking place in their bodies at every instant of every day. You know, we seem to think that we can, you know, not to say that we shut it off or shut on, because I'm arguing somewhat the same thing, but we, you know, we don't think about how this stuff flows through us, and we don't think about how much power that gives us to manipulate it and to deal with it on our own terms, whereas white nationalists and people in the right do that every single instant of every day. And that was, again, it just kind of goes back to what I was saying, is I want everybody to realize, I've been on this for a few months now, you know, we've got to come to terms with how much we've already destroyed, how much of their control we've already destroyed, you know. And when you use the term out of control, this is a big, very interesting concept, and it points to very particular extreme moments, you know, that this, again, you know, if we can harness this type of thinking, this type of, this willful turning our backs on who we are supposed to be, you know, who our enemies want us to be, who whatever wants us to be, who your ex-girlfriend's parents wanted you to be, you know, that, you know, this is the dereliction. These spaces where you are free to let your body become what it could possibly be, and this is what we were talking about when the guy that called in. So, you know, a lot of this stuff always ties in together, but it just seems to me sometimes we just need to be much more aware of how they tie in. You know, there's stuff that McLuhan wrote about. There's stuff that Bruno Latour, there's crazy, crazy great philosophy out there that talks about, you know, how we connect with each other in ways and how we, you know, once you leave meaning behind and get to a level of action that deals with your own personal transformations, you see that the revolt, or getting back to me raising my son, or the people that you mentioned that raised their children, you know, and with a total disregard for what's going on in this form of life. I mean, this is the revolt, though. This is what's going to happen in a few generations, you know. But for me, I've just given up on the idea that it has to be, you know, 150 million or trillion people or whatever it is. You know, honestly, if you look at the history of cultural formation and transformation or creation and degeneration, these are not mass phenomenon, bro. You know, the mass is there as the bottom of a pyramid. You know, it will support whatever is put on top of it to support, you know.
Well, I tend to think that there's always going to be an elite. It's just the question of, is it going to be very elite or are elite?
Well,
you know,
that's
what makes
it different. Yeah, and even in saying our elite, you know, now we kind of do this every stupid interview I do. It's like you get to the end of the second hour, and all of a sudden the thing springs to life. But when you say our elite, you know, okay, so what? Who is our elite? What will it be? Will it be the nationalists that want to keep everything in order and keep everybody at bay and create a new economic system that will properly, make the most of our human energy and capacity to uphold some type of economic system? Or will it be the guys like that are actually fighting the war? You know, is it going to be the warrior elite like you see in Sparta? Or is it going to be a corporate elite like you would see in some, you know, postmodern America where these guys think that, you know, all we need to do is kick out the color?
Well,
these are big, huge questions.
My vision for that is that, you know, it will be people who have a head on their shoulders like you and I do and anyone else associated with us who care about our own people, would like to see the advancement of the race rather than the degeneration, who have an idea of eugenics as a see, to me, eugenics is a big part. I mean, when you talk about Sparta, Sparta was so important because they were one of the first fascist societies, but they were very egalitarian as well. So they were like, they were almost fascist and egalitarian at the same time because they wanted to create. It was Darwinism, but, you know, no room for weaklings, but, you know, if you could show that you could throw a spear, if you could survive in the wilderness, if you could overcome natural odds, you know, you were a soldier, and as a soldier, it was an elite system where everybody kind of was on an equal level, and
right.
It was for the promotion of... a stronger people. I think that's what kills me the most is when I see Americans and they're fat and they're bloated and, you know, they're drinking Coca-Cola and, I mean, it's like, Mayor Bloomberg, he wanted to eliminate Pepsis or, you know, these soft drinks that were, I mean, to me, it's just like, it's so far beyond that point. I mean, America really,
it's
like it just sucks us into this world of hedonism. Like it's just all about pleasure and self-pleasure. And, you don't want to sacrifice anything for a higher ideal. You know, and there is no higher ideal. It's all, you are basically, as a unit, a purpose in yourself just to create wealth and power for yourself, not for a bigger perspective. So as a race, I think that Americanism has to die. I think that this country really has to go down in order for us to move forward. I don't know if you feel that way, but I think this country, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, the Enlightenment, where do you think our race, the European peoples as a whole, went wrong? I mean, I put it at the Enlightenment period where, we didn't go towards Darwinism and the socio-biological aspect of life, and we went more towards these ideals like equality and democracy and this type of thing, and it's all just a manipulation because we know that democracy today is a lie. It's all just about manipulating ideas based on the mass media and whoever controls information and communication. So to me, it's all a joke anyway, in the end, you know. And do we want to create a healthy, virile, strong person who is thoughtful and, you know, the mind-body connection? To me, you know, we've lost touch of both those aspects.
Sure.
And you can just go from there.
Yeah, that's a lot. number one, the Americanism thing, I think more so than kind of pulling our hair out about it, you know, it's something that we should think of as an ally. You know, that, like I said before, I mean, these guys, if we're, you know, we think that we're fighting to save a certain segment of this population in this country. I'm not fighting to save anything beyond my room and maybe five or six other guys. The people that will actually fight is who I'm fighting for. You know, I'm not trying to convince anybody that can't be convinced otherwise. You know, I just, it's not that I'm a pessimist in any way whatsoever. I just feel like you're talking about, well, where did we go wrong? We went wrong when we gave the power to decide to the weakest and the rabble and the most disgusting and degenerate people amongst us, you know. So the earned egalitarianism that you talk about with Sparta, the egalitarianism that is born in the trenches or through a situation, a series of situations where you know who you can depend on, you know, when everything in the world is falling against you. That's what the Greeks were talking about, you know. I mean, Alain de Benoist's book, The Problem of Democracy, is probably the seminal New Right book for me, as far as the one book that I would take into the future is that one, because it's the most clear explication of the differences between modern forms of social organization and modern political process and ancient. And even democratic Athens was, you know, a normal kind of CNN liberal would think that Athens was a fascist state, you know, and think that it was a horrible, you know, patriarchy and all of these other terrible things. And, you know, but we would read it and go, oh my God, this is just amazing. So the Americanism thing, I'm kind of going, you know, my thing changed when I went back to Deleuze, because I started to see that what we need to do, and especially through Deleuze's reading of Nietzsche, is to go, well, let's just, you know, instead of turning ourselves into some weird form of conservative, you know, stop trying to prop up the dying horse and kick his ass over along with whatever else is doing it. You know, we've got to get rid of this thing, man. We've got to – modernity and this form of life has to end for our war to succeed, and that's the bottom line for me. Some of these guys don't think so. Most nationalists would say no. They can deal with liberalism. They can deal with modernity. They just can't deal with people of color. I'm not that guy. You know, I'm at war with modernity. I'm at war with the political and social and cultural and intellectual processes that have gone on since Plato now is how far back that me and my guys have pushed it. You know, so you talk about where did we go wrong, the Enlightenment, we went wrong for me with Plato.
You're saying that conservatives are a bigger problem than liberals, in a sense.
Absolutely. I mean, isn't that odd? But yeah, absolutely. There's nothing that's conservative about me whatsoever. I don't want to conserve anything that I can't inherit myself from the pre-Socratic Greeks. And I love Rome more than anything, but Rome at this point is basically a modern state that's propped up with a very, very sick form of material nobility, you know. And this is the kind of stuff – yeah, tell me.
Well, William Pierce, he had an article called Enemies on the Right, and it was basically him describing the John Birch Society. And I think that's really it cuts to the core of what we're discussing now, because there's a huge segment of our people that are kind of on the fence and ready to turn over, but there's something that pulls them back, and it draws them into this world where they don't realize that there is nothing conservative about, you know, this society today. It is right. Neoliberalism and the left pretty much rule the show. I mean, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it's all within that context.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, now, you know, trying to go back, I mean, it depends on semantics and your definition, because if you're a conservative and you're a traditionalist and you're trying to go back to Sparta, well, an average Spartan or even an average American patriot from the revolutionary times wouldn't last 5 minutes in today's society. He would be considered an extremist or a terrorist or you know, just for his ideas, you know. So it kind of gets lost in this weird realm of how you're defining your terms. I mean, but I think conservatives personally, you know, it's like they know what's wrong, but they just they don't have willpower to get out there and fight physically, you know. So that's my problem with them is that, you know, they'll read books and they'll make commentaries and they'll do blogs, but they won't come out and say what they really feel. So,
well, you know, whatever it is, man, I don't know. Again, you know, I've been so kind of secluded in the last few months, and it's really, like I said before, man, you know, just create your little assemblage and see what becomes of it. And you see that so much of the energy, you know, that we burn on, just like what you guys were saying before, you don't fight the real enemy. You see all that stuff strips away from you just as quickly as your care for what's going on in contemporary America. And, you know, so I don't know, man. I don't want to get in a fight with neocons because I don't have anything in common with them. Their fight is not my fight. You know, the neoliberal paradigm is my enemy, and that's what I fight. The use of multiculturalism as a morality is what I fight. But at the same time, man, you know what? Like I said, I'm trying at this point to stop fighting for just a moment and say some things that certain guys can hear that they can affirm and be really, really, really joyous about. And the rest of the stuff ends up taking care of itself, man. I mean, we don't need our enemies to define what we talk about, you know?
Right.
We've got an extraordinary tradition, you know,
strength,
to talk
strength
about.
Strength and joy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I mean, let me just say real quick. There's Kerry Bolton, his new book is coming out very soon, any day now. I think it's called Babble Incorporated. And I still don't know why I was bestowed with the honor of writing this guy's the foreword to his book. You know, because Bolton and I are not, we don't have the same style, you know. Of course, he's written like 50 books at this point, so it's hard to say what my style would be at 50 books instead of six little essays. But his book is a really, really fantastic attack on how multiculturalism has been used in this process of dispossession. And when you read it, I urge everybody to read it. I don't know if I'll ever get around to writing a review of it, even though I already have like 70 pages of notes on it, because I read it, which is odd for me, you know, because I actually stopped and read something from start to finish. But it will give you a really good idea of the terms of the battle and who we need to start engaging. You know, it's not just the Jews, and it's not necessarily just the kind of conservative, liberal, weirdo bent to American politics. It's an entire kind of economic and political apparatus that is in play right now. But that apparatus doesn't go anywhere by voting it out, you know. But the apparatus, just like you're saying about American politics, well, it's kind of this thing. It's a sham. Yeah, it's a sham because it doesn't matter which side, who you vote in. It's the same process. It's the same, you know, they have the same rulers, let's say. They have the same constituents, whether we are them or not, you know. So, but you go, okay, well, just like we were saying before, man, how many more books do we need to read? Well, if you read that one and start talking about capitalism and start talking about liberal politics a little bit differently, and then in a year from now we can talk and we'll see how many you know, how we define the true enemy at that point.
Well, Renegade Broadcasting will be here to promote that book and your book and anything else that you produce, man, because we definitely view you as a soldier, an intellectual soldier, a physical soldier on the front line. So, you know, it was an honor to have you tonight. I have one more thing in my head. I saw a clip on YouTube. Okay, there's he's a Jewish guy, and he calls himself the Amazing Racist. And he goes around and he just antagonizes and instigates these scenarios where, you know, and this one particular one I'm thinking of was he had a ship, like a fake prop. It was like a ship. And he was engaging blacks on the street, basically offering them a trip back to Africa. Okay, and this raised so many like feelings in myself, because on the one hand, you know, I kind of applauded. I liked the way that he was so confrontational. He went up to interracial couples, and he, you know, I mean, it was just it was crazy. I mean, really, he ended up getting his ass kicked by a black, and you know, I mean, but the other side of me saw through it, and I, you know, I see how Jews kind of like promote racial antagonism here. It's almost like something that they kind of it's one of their money makers. You know, they kind of thrive off of this instigation, and you know. So, what are your opinions as to working with non-white peoples in America? I'm speaking specifically for an American context, not in Europe. I mean, over here where it's all kind of, you know, confused and befuddled, and you know, I mean, is it possible to create a black fascist? Is it possible to create a Mexican fascist that will oppose a Jewish system? I mean, what do you think regarding this? I mean, and this is very kind of theoretical and out there, but
you know,
but
what, though,
so what do you
as
think?
Theoretical as you think it might is, it's actually extremely relevant to my personal life, because I've always been much more comfortable with black radicals than white conservatives, right? So that's one of the reasons.
I agree. I actually agree.
That, yeah. So, like, that's one of the reasons for me that this whole kind of racial paradigm is doesn't really – it's not something that I have to fall back on or try to, you know, put in – I don't spend too much time trying to keep it in my arsenal when I don't need it sometimes. So – But you're talking about the antagonism. I mean, look at the Trayvon thing. It was a joke, and I don't even know anything about it, right? The only things that I know about any of it I saw on Facebook. But, you know, the best friend I've ever had in my whole life is a black kid. And he and I got into it over this Trayvon thing, and the day of the verdict was the last day that I've talked to him, right? Because he couldn't bear that I had a racial critique of the situation that discounted his ability to be an aggrieved black man, right? And so I deconstructed, to use this really nasty term that I can't believe I just said, I kind of went through the whole process with him going, bro, just tell me one thing. Tell me one way that you co-identify with this kid that wasn't created by the media, and I'll get off your back about it, you know? Speaking of confrontational, because I'm extremely non-confrontational, but I don't like people. I don't like to see people spewing bullshit that they learn from the media as if it is somehow some higher truth, like you were talking about before.
Right. It's a real
thing.
So,
you know, so that's my thing with all of it, though, is that, you know, I don't know if you saw that. The JFK movie that Oliver Stone did in the 80s, I guess, by now. My God. You know, but there's this crazy cool line of one of the skeptics is going, dude, you know, how do you even know who your mama is, basically? Do you know because somebody told you, you know, something like that. And that line always comes back to me with a lot of these kind of racial co-identification models and shit that were given by the media. Because they are trying to get you to co-identify with people that you have nothing in common with. You don't have an allegiance to these people. You don't have – they're trying to create an allegiance where one doesn't exist, basically, right? Not to your benefit. And that's always another one of these things. It's okay, you know, it's like why do these people care so much that all black people were supposedly shot that day that kid Trayvon was shot, you know? And why is it that the kid that shot him was white and not whatever something else, you know? So, like, I'm always kind of
playing. He wasn't even white. I mean, it was like, you know.
Yeah, it was a joke, dude. The whole thing is a joke. I mean, it's literally, it should have been the thing. It should have been the moment that the entire Citadel came crashing down. And instead, it was another block that was put, you know, on the foundation stone. I mean, it's a joke that people go along with this stuff. But our people kind of in a way too. I mean, I'm kind of looking at it going,
Well, yeah, we're
I'm
just
not,
as ignorant.
Like I said before, I'm
really
not.
Are.
Yeah, I'm not in this to save, you know, Bill Gates and his people. I don't care. You know, I don't have an allegiance to anybody that is a capitalist. I don't have an allegiance to anybody that is a conservative that couldn't even identify the problems in our cultural or civilizational situation or whatever, however you want to define it. You know, those aren't
right.
the people that I'm dealing with. So again, I'm not a racialist in any way in this. I'm not a nationalist in any way in this. What I'm doing is trying to get the right guys to fight for themselves, and the whole thing will come crashing down regardless.
But to me, being a racialist or a nationalist would automatically exclude anybody that doesn't understand those concepts to begin with. Like, you know, if somebody starts if somebody starts quoting Ayn Rand or, you know, something like that as their fundamental motivation for being in the struggle, I mean, that's gonna deter me. I mean, you know, I want to see somebody who understands. It's a little harder as an American. See, that's the thing is Americans, A, are of mixed European descent. B, you know, for 200 years, they haven't been in touch with their cultural traditions. So that's
right.
why, like Europe and this country really are so different because,
yeah.
you know, we are so easy to kind of be distracted. It's so easy to push us off the course that we want to go because we haven't even though we're around each other and we see it in each other's eyes and our blood and our you know we look at each other and you know it's just that familial feeling you know we don't have it because we've been distracted by sports and baseball and football and you know all these other things so I think this country really you know, it'd be interesting to see how natural instincts come out when survival is at stake. When it comes down to you know your small group of people that have banded together, and whether it will be you know something that we've never seen before. I mean, you know, all these people who identify based on being an American. At the root of it, what do they really have? There's a lot of people that are interracial and they mix and they've completely forgotten about their biology. But in Europe, that's still intact, you know. And over here, it's still intact, but not at such a primitive primal level. So sure. I don't know, man. It's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing plays out. And I definitely want to have you back on my show, man. It was a pleasure to have you on tonight. I know you're probably – you want to go next time. I'd like to get more into the philosophical aspect of your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm down with that.
You know, go into some specific philosophers and Nietzsche and, you know, everything else. I know it was his birthday not too long ago. But, Wolf, I'm going to ask you, do you want to ask anything before I cut it off here tonight?
No, not really. Am I still on?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, I didn't know that. My God. I can't believe you didn't hear all the gurgling and walking around and everything I did.
No.
Okay. No, the quality numbers. Quality numbers. You know, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, I won't go into the ninth one. I've got these post-its I always write during these shows. But the last one ends up quality numbers. And I think that's what Dr. Dial is getting at, and we all want to get at. Me in my secondary and tertiary leadership roles, that's what we really have to push, and I think that's what he's pushing too. We can't expect a philosopher king to come along every 5 years, 10 years, or 100 years, but we can always develop up to that point and hope for the best, you know.
Yeah.
Quality numbers. And I'm going to stick with that. I got a lot of other stuff written here. I'm sticking with that. I think that's what he wants. I think that's what I want. I think that's what we all want.
Yeah, I think that's what I want, too. I think that's what I want,
too.
You know,
Look,
you guys, man, if we were together in person, I think we have to get off the Internet, too. I mean, I think the Internet needs to be used as a tool.
Yeah.
But you know, we just did a Renegade Roadshow. We went across the country. I didn't, but Kyle and Mike, you know, we all got together in person, and they met up with listeners across the entire nation. They had great interviews, and that's what we need to do. I mean, we have to bring this down to a flesh and blood reality level. I mean, it has to get off this internet. I mean, because no one's going to do anything if they don't really feel like they want to fight for something. And once they see that there is so much more we can accomplish together, unified, you know, in person, I mean, that's what we have to get to. And it's all about local, you know, organization and networking and all that. So even though you might be far away from me, man, intellectually we're on the same exact level, and I agree 100% with what you say, and I think you're an amazing speaker, man. I'm so happy to have you on the program. So we'll have you back, man, whenever you want to come. And, you know, just we can go now with anything else you wanted to say or promote, man.
Yeah, cool.
So, go ahead.
No, I appreciate it, Dan. And I'll say this just in closing. I don't know how much – I know we're over time, but, you know, the local thing is really important, and that's one of the things that's changed for me in the last few months is that I've actually met, you know, people, and I've had dinner with people, and I've gone and – gone up to the mountains with people, with these guys and with their spouses, and you know, all of a sudden that becomes the revolt, you know, is spending passing time with people where where what's going on, you know, civilizationally stops for a minute, that the only thing that matters at that moment is the triumph of who we are, you know, and who we're trying to become, or however you want to talk about it. You know, and beautiful stuff is going on. People are getting married. Beautiful, great, smart kids, fantastic people are amongst us and that are a part of what we're trying to do. And, you know, occasionally we just need to kind of sit back. I don't want to be, like, gooey about it, but it's a really extraordinary thing to see how smart, you know, and how many avenues of subversion and how many avenues of corruption we've already got going on, and we don't I don't know, but you know, it's hard to kind of congratulate yourself on a war that hasn't even started, but in a lot of ways, on a day-to-day basis, you know, these are huge victories, man, that we're doing stuff. Now, people like me and you are out there, you know, and I'm using my real name and all this stuff because I can, you know, and because I feel like we need to have a legitimate face now and again that's not whoever, Joe Schmo 357 at whatever, you know. You know, but there are kids that have to use an alias because they have to, and there's people that have to use some serious subterfuge to keep this stuff under wraps for now, but that's okay too. It's fantastic, you know, because we are learning things. We're being put in situations where we're learning stuff that we can use that is so invaluable for what we're trying to do. And our enemies are helping the process along every minute of every day. So again, you know, it's like there's a lot going on right now, dude. And your process, your show is a part of it. You know, the little things that I get to write now and again, me with my family, all of us with our families, all of us with everybody that we know, all these assemblages that we're a part of, and all these lines that are connecting us, even if they are virtual at this moment, this is all real stuff, man. So, you know, be proud of what you're doing, and don't get down, you know, too hard on the bullshit that we have to go through to do it. Because, you know, I wouldn't want to do anything else.
Real quick, Mark, I wanted to ask you about music. Like, what are you into musically? Like, because I find that heavy metal and it's all of its genres and subcultures is a great channel for us to you know, flow these ideas through. And it doesn't have to be heavy metal. It can be anything. It can be classical music. It can be you know, just skinhead music, you know, anything, or oi music, anything that brings you to that level where you feel a connection to your people. And you know, I just I try to play a spectrum on this network. We play all different types of stuff. We really think that music as an element of culture is a huge part of it. And I'm just curious to know, what are your influences, or what do you enjoy, you know, for pleasure listening to musically?
You know, I'm really an audiophile, to be honest with you. I was brought up from the day I was born with music, and genre-wise, I do listen to a lot of really extreme music. I really, really love hardcore music, even the as much as I can tolerate of the sappy kind of leftist bullshit that passes for hardcore these days. Don't listen to a lot of death metal. It just kind of comes and goes for me really, really quickly. But, you know, there's certain kind of sort of mainstream bands like Meshuggah that I really enjoy. I still listen to a lot of stuff from my childhood, so I'm really stuck on the Cult right now, like the Love album and Electric and kind of, you know, these really early kind of weird Cult stuff. I listen to Dire Straits, which I inherited from my dad that I love. Really, I guess my thing becomes more about, and the Civil Wars right now. I can't get enough of the Civil Wars, although I don't really listen to a lot of, like, real Appalachian music. I really like, you know, single instrument, singer-songwriter type stuff now and again. So, you know, I'm all over the place, but mostly...
Anything folkish or anything like that? I mean, it's like...
Yeah, I mean, I it's like I can do bits and pieces here and there, but it's not like I've fallen in love with folk music or even kind of folkish music. Some of the stuff that Arctos has put out, I listen to it, but then I just kind of go, well, I don't know. I don't need false grandeur at this point.
Right.
You know? Stuff is grand enough as it is. I don't need
some
false stuff to try to make me, you know, fall in love with a sunset that I'm already in love with, you know.
I want to get your interpretation really quickly of these lyrics. This is Neurosis, A Sun That Never Sets. And it's very quick. A sun that never sets burns on. New light is this river's dawn. When to speak of a word so old is to relearn what is known. A time to think back and move on. Rebuild the loves of lives long gone. The blood that flows through me is not my own. The blood is from the past, not my own. The blood that leads my life is not my own. The blood is strength. I'm not alone. And to me, what that means is basically he's admitting that he's sacrificing his own individuality to collective, to the higher racial soul. I mean, he's admitting that he is a link in a chain. Extending from the infinite past into the future and eternity, and that's what it's all about. That's what fascism is to me. I mean,
I couldn't say much more about it than that. So good job.
All right, brother, man, it was an honor to have you on tonight. Anytime
you
want to come back, you are welcome, and you're a great speaker. Everybody, just go to Countercurrents, Mark Dial, Dyal. Look up his essay.
I have my website too, and it's, you know, the website it's not in jest, but it's very dormant right now. But there's still stuff there that at least point you there to other places. So, It's just my name, markdial.com. No dash,
right.
No space. So MarkDyal.
Great.
It was supposed to be an academic site that acted as a buffer to get people to not go any further than that if I was going to get a job, but I quickly turned it into self-promotion and, you know, so it's...
Yeah. Well, Mark,
people can find me. I'm on Facebook. I mean, I'm kind of doing the normal social thing, so I'm on Instagram even at this point, so, you know, great.
Word. Well, hey, man, I mean, you know, don't give up on getting a job. At some point, I think you might find somebody who is sympathetic that just hires you, and you've got to put yourself in an area or a location that is more susceptible to our ideas, and never give up, man. It's, you know, the struggle is what it's all about. So I'm gonna close it up here. It was an honor to have you on tonight, man. It was a great conversation, and you are an excellent speaker, man. I gotta say.
I'm working
all right,
on it anyway.
We'll have you back.
I'm gonna hang up whenever you close it, okay, buddy?
All right, we're gonna go into the song now, and you know, it'll be great to talk to you again, brother. Take care.
You got it, brother.
Hail.
Gotcha.
right, guys, that was Neurosis with A Sun That Never Sets. And I wanted to just remind people, I opened up the show with Zyklon. That was Zycloned was the name of the song off there from their album World of Worms. And I played that song because it has a very metal, industrial kind of sound to it. I knew my guest was a Nietzschean, so, you know, I wanted to convey that kind of cold feel where you have hammers and just this sense of a mechanical society that is deracinated from nature. It's a very existentialist theme in the lyrics, so I put that in there to begin with. I thought my guest was great tonight. We appreciated having him on. Mark Dial, that's D-Y-A-L. You can just go to Countercurrents and Google his name. You'll find plenty of articles and essays that he has written. And that's about it, guys. Just listen to every show here on Renegade Broadcasting. We've got a just amazing lineup here of hosts here. So all their shows, everything, I recommend it to any listener who might be kind of strolling along and just finding us out of the blue, you know, you never know. And that's about it. Just go to also renegadetribune.com. That's our literary wing, you know, where we kind of let loose some essays and things of that nature. And we also have alternativesocial.com as well, so check that out. And that's about it, guys. I'm going to sign out. I had enough for tonight. I thought it was a great great discussion, and we will be with you again on another edition of Imperium Europa. This is General Antiochus signing out. Take care.